Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Customs and Border Protection operations began here on Saturday. In the first 48 hours, more than 130 people were detained. Of those, 44 allegedly had criminal records. Two were allegedly confirmed gang members. For the moment, we must take those claims at face value. Local law enforcement is keeping its distance from the federal government's Operation Charlotte's Web, and we're not certain where the detainees have been taken, which means any information about them must come from Border Patrol. What we do know, unequivocally, is that what appears to be random targeting of individuals has resulted in heightened fear in immigrant communities. The result has been the closure of some local businesses that normally cater to that population. And nearly 30,000 students were absent from CMS on Monday, with Hispanic students disproportionately affected. We also know, like what we've witnessed in Los Angeles and Chicago, this is yet another display of the blatant disregard of the due process rights guaranteed by the Constitution and the attempted normalization of a sight rarely seen on American streets. Masked men in military garb carrying high-performance military weapons, hauling individuals out of stores and vehicles, often wrestling them to the ground, some American citizens, and hauling them away in unmarked vehicles. This is the stuff of authoritarian dictatorships. Later in the hour, we will bring you the topic we originally scheduled for today, but last night, the Mecklenburg County Commission took up a resolution in support of the immigrant community, and we start there with the resolution's principal sponsor, Mecklenburg County Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell. Welcome back to the program. Susan, good morning.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So last night, Mecklenburg County Commission took up a proclamation in support of the constitutional protections guaranteed all persons within our borders and expressing support for our immigrant community, and you were the resolution's principal sponsor. But before we talk about that, let's get into some of the nuts and bolts of what's been going on here the last several days. Prior to the arrival of Customs and Border Protection, leaders from the governor on down were left in the dark. After they arrived, the federal government didn't seem to change their communication practices, meaning they didn't communicate at all. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden apparently had a conversation with federal officials on Monday after a weekend of roundups and disruptions. What did he learn? What do you and other members of the county commission know that perhaps you didn't know on Saturday or that we don't know today?
I don't know anything that you don't know or that the public doesn't know. I've heard nothing. Like, we get no extra intel or anything like that. Zero.
I read out statistics a second ago in terms of the numbers of arrests made by Border Patrol over the weekend. There were 130 people, allegedly 44 had criminal records. Now that number is closer to 200 people. But do you have a more current account or count of that, and how many people are allegedly involved in criminal activity?
I do not have a breakdown of that.
Anyone?
I don't know. Honestly, I really don't know. Isn't this incredible? One of the things in our resolution last night called for knowing who is being detained, where they're being detained, how these things are happening. And so we literally don't have that information. So I think the closest people that might be the Carolina Migrant Network, because they have the hotline that folks are calling. And so they may have some more data around that or more specifics, but we don't.
So the information we have about alleged criminals among those rounded up, two of whom were supposedly gang members, all come from Border Patrol. To the best of your knowledge, has local law enforcement, have members of the commission, have city leaders, does the mayor, does the city council, have they been able to verify any of what Border Patrol is saying?
No, not to my knowledge.
Your colleague.
And I wouldn't believe, but you know, the track record is we can't really believe what they say. So I've seen nothing.
And your colleague on the County Commission last night, at large Commissioner Lee Altman, said that no one on County Commission opposes legitimate law enforcement, but she also threw down the gauntlet.
It is also plain that these actions were designed to sow terror. They were designed to intimidate. And I challenge the president and I challenge federal law enforcement that was in leadership and directed these events to show us the warrant signed by a judge, to show us the probable cause that justified the arrest, and to show us the previous criminal conviction that justified each and every one of the 200 seizures that took place. I don't think you can, but I put the gauntlet down and show us where this was legitimate.
If past is prologue, do we even know what's been happening in Los Angeles and Chicago? Have they answered that same question in those cities? And do you anticipate getting that information anytime soon or ever?
You know, Mike, I really can't answer that. I think what I would love to see is where the Attorney General might have that kind of information. I actually spoke to Attorney General Jeff Jackson the other night because I invited him to come to our meeting. Or to send a representative. And he said he was actually in DC working behind the scenes to try to get them out. And so
I know that I know that federal law trumps state and local law. That's just how it is in the country. But if the federal government is breaking the law, if they're breaking constitutional norms, can the state attorney general sue them?
I think that's a fantastic question. I'm not an attorney, so I don't know who can do what, but I would assume that would be the person in that we can appeal to. And so, you know, we had a speaker last night who said, you know, violence for political purposes is terrorism. So, and everyone agreed with that. Like, yes, this is terrorism and it's being perpetrated by our own government. And so this is just something that I can't wrap my head around, and I don't know how we can sit by and let it happen. But yet, what do you do? You have to have law enforcement of some sort, which to me has to be at the state level.
Everybody in Mecklenburg County government is a Democrat. All but two members of city council at the moment are Republicans. There will soon only be one Republican beginning December the 1st when council change is over. So it may be a silly question to ask you because you're a Democrat involved in local government. But can you tell me why you believe these forces are in Charlotte?
Well, thank you for that question. And I do believe it's for political purposes. I think this whole shock and awe show is for political purposes. And, you know, I think one reason that Charlotte is targeted, that North Carolina is being targeted, is because we have a very important Senate race coming up in 2026. And so, you know, anything you can do to smear local Democratic leadership, or even leadership at our state level, that's what this president and this administration is going to do.
Which is what I anticipated. That's what I anticipated the answer to be. So let me flip the coin, because some Republicans have blamed the need for this operation on Sheriff Gary McFadden's refusal to cooperate in the past with ICE. To be clear, Sheriff McFadden has said he has been cooperating with them within the limits of the law, and that cooperation has in fact picked up since the legislature passed yet a new law to require more participation. He's following those mandates. What's your view on Sheriff McFadden's role in causing this incursion into Mecklenburg County?
Well, I think that's ridiculous. I don't think that he bears the responsibility for this. I think the responsibility is all at the federal level. And, you know, Sheriff McFadden is following the letter of the law, and that is what he has to do. And so I don't think that anyone can sort of say that he's brought this on because of, you know, anything that he has done. I think that he has stayed within the letter of the law. And when the General Assembly changes the law, he had to comply with that, and he has.
You were the primary sponsor of the resolution that was introduced at County Commission last night. At the top of that proclamation, you mentioned, quote, Mecklenburg County is one of the largest and most diverse counties in North Carolina, home to foreign-born residents from more than 187 countries who collectively speak over 205 languages. And you go on to point out that our immigration population here has grown by more than 126% since the year 2000, making up about 16.5% of our current population. That's more than 150,000 people. But the ones being targeted in this situation appear to be strictly Latinos. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, this is classic racial profiling. I mean, this, and in part of our resolution, we actually say racial or ethnic profiling is unacceptable, unlawful, and inconsistent with the constitutional guarantees. How can it be that it's still happening, even though it is against the law? But yes, Latinos are the ones who are mostly impacted by this. And we know that Latinos, they have a lower rate of crime. It doesn't matter if you're naturalized, if you are any status that you are, they have a lower crime rate. They are impacting our economy in the, like, I think last night someone gave the statistics of $12.9 billion of our GDP is related to the Latino community. And so, you know, that just, you can't ignore that.
As you said in your proclamation, you point out that racial or ethnic profiling is unacceptable, unlawful, and inconsistent with constitutional guarantees like due process and the right to freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, both parts of the Constitution, both of which are being trampled or ignored here and in other cities targeted by the Trump administration. In your opinion, is this a lawless administration? Or are they doing what they legitimately feel is necessary, as they insist, to keep Americans safe?
Well, I'm going to try to say this in the nicest way that I possibly can. That is BS, okay? It is BS that this is for safety reasons. This has nothing to do with that. And I understand that, this administration wants to scapegoat the Latino population. And I think that everyone who has an honest look at what the impact of Latinos is on our community, on our nation, anyone who's looking at it honestly knows that they have a positive impact and that this is all political theater meant to just gin up the base.
And Donald Trump keeps telling us that he has a mandate because he won the election in a landslide, which is absolutely not true. It's a lie.
He
won by 1.5% of the vote. But nonetheless, he controls the entire Republican Party. So
right.
If he wanted to, would it not be true, as a politician, you would know this, would it not be true that he could work some sort of legislation through the Congress and get it passed and get it signed into law that would perhaps fix what everybody admits, Democrats and Republicans alike, is a broken immigration system, rather than focusing on activities like this, which are out of the norms for American government?
Yeah, well, if we had a real president who really wanted to fix problems, we would have that. We would have legislation. We would have reforms to the immigration system. We wouldn't just have political theater. And so, you know, anybody who thinks that this is legitimate, I mean, I can't wait until the day when actual due process comes back, because it will. I believe it will. And when that time comes, there will be an answer to all of this.
City Council District 6 Representative Susan Rodriguez McDowell is our guest this morning. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Susan in just a moment in Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In this first segment, we have an action-packed show today. We have three different topics. We have Susan Rodriguez McDowell. She is the District 6 representative on Mecklenburg County Commission and the principal sponsor of a proclamation supporting the immigrant community that passed unanimously last night at their meeting of the county commission. You admit that the federal government has jurisdiction over immigration policy and enforcement, but you add that local governments retain the responsibility to, quote, advocate for the well-being, dignity, and constitutional rights of the people they serve. Your proclamation does that, but is it rather like thoughts and prayers following a mass shooting? Is it rather impotent?
You know, I think that's a fair point. Definitely, I think people in our chamber last night were asking for more than just words. And, you know, I want to offer more than just words, but we do have to stay within our own authority. And so what I'm looking at are, you know, what are the long-term effects of this going to be? And how will the county be positioned to help? You know, I think this is going to cause, you know, this is going to cause trauma and in children, in adults. I mean, this isn't going to be just a one and done. Like if they leave, I've heard some people say they're going to leave by Friday and move on to another city. And if that's the case, the effects of this are going to be felt for a very long time.
Well, they're moving on to Raleigh this morning. I think they're in Raleigh today. Unlike the mayor of Chicago and the governor of Illinois, who were quite outspoken about this in recent months, local leaders in Mecklenburg, in Charlotte, even the governor himself, have been everything from silent to merely subdued in their pushback. Why?
That's a great question. I think that there is... I think there would be room for some more response from a little more energy in the response from our state level. I think at the local level, especially from the county, you know, we have come out strongly. And, you know, fear is bad for business, right? Like where's the business community? This is supposed to be the business town, right? Where this is the Charlotte way, where you have kind of the business community handling some of these kinds of things, especially when you're talking about the Republican, you know, government. And so I'm kind of saying, well, where are those guys? Where is this fear? Like the sites for construction that are shut down, the stores that are closed, the businesses, the people that are not coming out. You know, this is bad for business. So where's the business community calling for an end to this?
Are you hampered in any way by the fact that the Republican congressional delegation and most of the people in our congressional delegation are Republicans, and the fact that the legislature is controlled by Republicans, the fact that they are all in favor of this, is that hampering any efforts or is it putting a damper on anything that you could say?
I mean, I can say whatever I want, but I'm just telling you that I don't have authority to do anything different, right. You know? And so, you know, at some point you have to use what authority you do have and try to, you know, do what you can. But literally, I don't know. I'm asking those questions because I'm part of the National Association of Hispanic Elected Leaders, County Leaders. And so I've been reaching out to my colleagues all across the country, and we're all scrambling to try to think of ways to respond to this. And so it's something that we're building as we're going, you know, to try to respond to this unprecedented attack.
In your proclamation, the County Commission, quote, urges the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and U.S. Border Patrol, CMPD, and the Sheriff's Office to collaborate. The sheriff has been out front on this. He's been appearing on CNN, on MSNBC, and other news outlets. CMPD has been absolutely silent about this, but stated that they are not working with Border Patrol. You also call for timely and transparent notification of who was taken into custody, under what legal authority, where they were transported, and the justifications for such actions, precisely what we heard Lee Altman say a few minutes ago. Do you anticipate hearing from those authorities, federal authorities?
No, I don't anticipate hearing from them. And when we talk about collaborating, asking CMPD and the sheriff to collaborate, what I'm really speaking about there is in keeping our people safe, because we have to make sure that things don't cross over into where folks, I mean, I feel like this has already happened some, that, you know, we need to, I know people have called CMPD for help when they're being chased by these masked, gun-toting, military-style, you know, gear that they're decked out in. I know they've called CMPD, and CMPD has tried to guide them to go to someplace safe. But what I'm calling for is for them to protect people.
And part of this, and I got to let you go because I have to move on to other segments, but part of this is an attempt to normalize this kind of activity in the United States, to normalize people in military garb carrying military rifles, pointing them at American citizens, pointing them at people, doesn't matter whether they're citizens or not, without a warrant, without due process, without cause, simply to make a point. That as a politician facing midterm elections coming up and the 28 presidential election coming up, with a president in office who tried to thwart the last election, does it concern you that this normalization is taking place?
Read between the lines. If you could see my hair on fire, my hair would be on fire. Literally, I don't know what else to do to express myself. And I think that a lot of Democrats feel that way. Like, how are we in this position where this this person is reelected after January 6th and is given this authority to do all of this without any checks and balances from the rest of the government? Where in the hell is Congress, right? And the Supreme Court, like, how are they not, you know, putting a stop to this? I can't understand it. I really can't. I don't know how my fellow Americans are sitting by and their hair's not on fire as well. I literally don't understand it. And, you know, I have nothing more.
Susan Rodriguez McDowell represents District 6 on Mecklenburg County Commission. Her proclamation supporting the immigrant community, which she introduced and sponsored, passed unanimously last night. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you highlighting this and letting the whole community know about it. So thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. Now on to the topic we originally scheduled for the hour. Later, what you need to know if you intend to install solar power before those tax credits expire. But first, a conversation with John Searby. He is the executive director of both the Catawba Riverkeeper Organization and the Daniel Stowe Conservancy, as well as the CEO of the collaboration that was started between those two organizations in 2023. Thank you for being here. And I want to point out that you were going to be on the program Monday and you got pushed to Wednesday and then got shortened because of today. But so thank you, and we're sorry. You're the executive director of two organizations. How did that happen?
Well, Mike, about 2.5 years ago, both organizations, which are about 10 minutes apart, Catawba Riverkeepers headquarters in McAdenville, Daniel Stowe Conservancy is in Belmont, started looking into some ways to improve some administrative overhead and find some economies of scale. And so we started to explore those, doing some shared resources around finance, HR, facilities, those types of things. And as we got into that relationship, we uncovered a lot of really interesting partnership opportunities. And so it's evolved over the last 2.5 years, and it's grown. And as both organizations have continued to grow, after 2.5 years of the partnership, about a month and a half, 2 months ago, I went to the boards and said, it's time for me to kind of make a decision about which organization I'm going to focus on. And so Catawba Riverkeeper is in a search for their new executive director, and the partnership will continue, but each organization will have a named executive director moving forward.
You have been in your position as with the Riverkeeper organization since 2019, and you became executive director at Daniel Stowe in 2023. That's kind of when this collaboration between the two organizations began. Clearly, as head of both organizations for several years, you saw value or synergy or both in these organizations. Talk about that. Why do they complement each other?
Yeah, I think on the surface, there's some real obvious things. Both organizations are focused on conservation, but in different lanes. Riverkeeper obviously focused on water quality across the entire region, where Stowe is a 380-acre preserved property on the banks of Lake Wylie and has the opportunity to talk about conservation to the public in a very unique way because of the number of visitors that come every year. But behind the scenes, at their core, they're very similar. They have a core group of scientists at the garden. It is botanists and horticulturists. At the Riverkeeper, it's biologists and hydrologists. And then the organizations have wraparound services for education, for experiential opportunities, for volunteerism. And so structurally, they're pretty similar, even though they may operate slightly differently. And what we found is that there's a lot of things that the Riverkeeper needs support around, things like building out a restoration greenhouse program where they have plants and things that are needed for restoration of the creeks and streams in the region, but they don't have a huge piece of property to be able to grow those. Stowe has that. And similarly, there's creeks and streams running through Stowe's property that need attention and need the support of Riverkeeper staff. So we've been able to find some interesting collaboration ways beyond the administrative benefits that we found.
The idea of Riverkeepers started in the mid-1960s. We talked about this before with the actual Catawba Riverkeeper, Brandon Jones. It started in 1966 in New York State along the Hudson River to help fishermen on the Hudson River keep that water safe for fishing. And then it expanded out. It seems to have exploded in recent years because lots of communities now have Riverkeepers. And your organization has 8,000 members and it spans 26 counties. How much of that growth occurred during your time at the helm?
I'm really proud to say that we've really increased the size and impact of the organization during my time. We had about 1,000 members when I took over in 2019, and really were very laser focused on Charlotte and Lake Norman, Lake Wylie issues. And over the last 6.5 years, we've been able to grow that membership, which allows us to grow our impact. Not only do we have an office in the central part of the basin in McAdenville, but we have an office in Morganton, North Carolina, to work with our northern basin neighbors. We have an office in Rock Hill, South Carolina, to work with our southern basin neighbors. And so, you know, in any kind of advocacy movement, you're only as good as the voices you represent. And in order to increase the voice of Catawba Riverkeeper, we had to expand the membership and grow the impact. And now with over 8,000 members across 26 counties in North and South Carolina, you know, we're starting to see the results of that impact. When we show up at Raleigh and talk about water quality issues, elected officials pay attention to 8,000 voices. And so it's been great to see how water quality is probably one of the few bipartisan, nonpartisan issues. You know, there are people on both sides of the aisle who believe that we all need clean water. And so that, I think, is a direct result of the way we've grown the organization. You know, we were the 23rd Riverkeeper organization in the United States, and we were a small little group, but now we're the 10th largest in the country.
Talk about some of the accomplishments that you have had at the Riverkeeper organizations since as long as you've been in charge, because you have some notches on your belt, including in 2019, the settlement with Duke Energy to remove about 100 million tons of coal ash from 6 sites in the state, including 2 on the Catawba River Basin. And in 2023, as you pointed out, you opened the satellite offices north and south of Charlotte and Morganton and Rock Hill. Talk about some of the other things that you feel are your major accomplishments.
Well, the coal ash settlement is the organization's greatest accomplishment in 28 years of its history. And I just happened to be the one sitting in the chair with the pen who got to sign the document. You know, that was 10 years of executive directors, riverkeepers, board members, members of the organization. But that really, the closing of that chapter of the organization and getting that cleanup started really allowed us to think differently about the organization. And, you know, I think the growth of the organization has been something I've been really proud of, but probably the thing I'm most proud of is the collaboration that we've been able to accomplish. You know, when I took over, I was really frustrated by the fact that you had seven or eight environmental nonprofits in the Charlotte region, all working adjacent to each other and not talking to each other very often. We had fantastic higher education institutions. They were doing great work in this space and not collaborating. And so our organization during my time has really put a focus on collaboration. And now I'm really proud of the work we're doing alongside Catawba Lands Conservancy, the Carolina Thread Trail, the Foothills Conservancy of North Carolina, Sustain Charlotte, Clean Air NC, the Anne Springs Close Greenway, Tree Charlotte, Raptor Center. You know, we're all talking to each other on a regular basis because at the root of all of our challenges to our natural resources is the fact that we live in a rapidly growing region. And that development is a challenge and a pressure on our natural resources. So if we're not working together, it's going to be really hard for us to make this a great place to live for future generations.
Being in silos is not unusual, and getting people to cooperate, it seems to me, might be a little difficult because everybody has their own particular area of self-interest, whether you're an organization or an individual. How difficult has it been to accomplish this collaborative effort that you've established?
You're right, Mike. I mean, it's probably one of the hardest things, getting organizations to work together. But it takes a commitment that everybody is sees the value, but then you have to continually remind each other. That's the biggest challenge is whenever you talk, everybody nods their head and goes, yeah, we should be working together. We should be working together. But you have to find meaningful ways to do it. So we've used things like the Central Basin Symposium, where all these groups come together. We bring higher ed, we bring for-profit together. We bring Duke Energy, we bring the other utilities in to say, you know, what are our biggest challenges and what are each of us doing to address that. And so just convening people on a regular basis in the same room goes a long way in developing collaboration. And even though I'm making a transition, I hope that'll continue.
What we haven't talked about is your other job, and that is the job of executive director executive director of the Daniel Stowe Conservancy. So we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about that organization and your efforts there as well. We're here with John Searby on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We're coming right back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting author Robin Wall Kimmerer, known for braiding sweetgrass and the service berry, sharing perspectives on Indigenous knowledge and ecology on December 2nd at the Gambrill Center. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. John Searby is with us. He is the executive director of the Catawba Riverkeeper Organization and the Daniel Stowe Conservancy, but he's giving up one of those jobs to concentrate on the conservancy and to remain the CEO of the collaboration between those two organizations. And let's talk about Daniel Stowe, because you became executive director there, I believe, in 2023, are maintaining that position. And one of the first things that happened after you arrived is you changed the name. It used to be Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden, and now it is the Daniel Stowe Conservancy. Why the name change, and what is the role of the Conservancy?
So the name change is actually a return to the organization's original name. When Dan Stowe set this 380 acres aside for the benefit of the community, the legal name of the nonprofit is the Daniel J. Stowe Conservancy. And so Dan had a vision that this place would be a place that people could explore and be inspired by nature. And he had a particular passion for botanical gardens, so that's where he started his efforts. And that's why over the last 25 years, the gardens have really been the central branding of the property and the organization. And that's not going away. The 90-acre botanical gardens are still the centerpiece and the crown jewel of our property. But we felt like the time was right to really make that broader tent an opportunity for people to explore our property beyond the gardens and come out and explore the 8 acres or the 8 miles of trail that we have and the 3.5 miles of Lake Wylie shoreline that we have and our 90 acres of botanical gardens. So the name change was really about trying to express to the community all of the things that this property has to offer and was really a vision of our board to really create a broader, more inclusive environment for people who have a love of gardens, but may be are not formal garden enthusiasts to come out and be a part of it.
The Daniel Stowe Conservancy has these gardens, and that's one way people can actually touch and feel and see and be part of the organization. But the Catawba Riverkeeper organization also depends on individuals because you can't do it on yourself. You're highly reliant on volunteers. So how would you like local citizens to interact with either or both of these organizations?
Yeah, one of the reasons I'm so excited about the future at Daniel Stowe Conservancy is I think we have an opportunity to help open the eyes and expose the public to the work of other conservation organizations. You know, we have the benefit of having 150,000 people a year walk through our front gates to explore our property, whether it's here for holiday lights or they're here for our garden events. And that's a unique platform to be able to tell the story of the other great conservation work that's going on. You know, as the Charlotte region grows and becomes more stressed on our green spaces, people are seeking out a place where they can just be out in nature and not hear cars and not see houses and then walk in the green grass. And so one of the reasons I'm excited about continuing my work at Stowe is to be able to tell the story of Catawba Riverkeeper, to tell the story of Catawba Lands Conservancy and others that are doing work in the conservation space in the Charlotte region. Because I think there's a need, because the only thing that is going to make these natural resources protected for generations is if the people get involved and they have to talk to their elected officials and they have to talk to their community leaders about acting on behalf of their water, air, wildlife, and protecting those things. And so our vision at Stowe is to not only be a place where you can be inspired, but you do something with that inspiration. And so, you know, we're bringing the partners to our property and asking them, how can we help tell your story? And that's, I think, one of the cool ways that we're going to continue this partnership beyond my time as executive director at Catawba Riverkeeper.
John Searby is going to continue in his role as executive director of the Daniel Stowe Conservancy and remain as CEO of the collaboration between that organization and the Riverkeeper organization. Thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
You're welcome. Federal solar tax credits are set to expire at the end of the year, but homeowners, businesses, and nonprofits still have an opportunity to get solar installed at a discounted price. But you have to enroll for that by next Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. And WFAE climate reporter Zachary Turner has everything you need to know about applying, why you might want to apply, and more. So let's get right to it. Welcome back. When did this program offering this discounted price begin, and why is it set to expire?
Absolutely. So this is the Solarize Charlotte-Mecklenburg program, which means it's only available in the Mecklenburg area. And this is something that's been running since I think like late spring, early summer. So folks have already been enrolling. We've had about 289 people signing up to get solar or solar plus battery storage on their homes. And what this is a group purchase program. It basically gives people a discounted rate because everyone's kind of coming together to buy solar at one time. And that is driving down the cost of solar, which is important right now because, as you mentioned, we're about to see these solar tax credits expire.
And they're expiring because when Donald Trump came back into office, he canceled that tax credit early. It was supposed to expire in 2032. At the same time, he expanded federal subsidies for oil extraction. Putting more people on solar, however, would leave more oil and gas for other energy needs that are not going to go away. And so if you want the nation to be energy independent, which we were prior to the Trump administration, why would you take these credits away?
Well, I guess I've heard some, the arguments that I've heard from maybe some more conservative groups is that they want the industry to stand on its own two legs.
But the oil and gas industry does not stand on its own. They get subsidies all the time.
And that's exactly what the solar and clean energy people would say, is that it's not a level playing field. And that is what a lot of solar installers have said. They say, look, we understand your argument. You want us to be playing on an even playing field. Then why not completely level the playing field? If you're going to get rid of these, I guess what you could consider subsidies for solar in terms of the 25D tax credit or some of the changes they've made to the commercial solar tax credit, then why not get rid of the subsidies for oil and gas as well?
So the Trump White House has referred to solar and other clean energy sources as unreliable, which flies in the face of what industry experts say. Is it a matter simply of different policy agendas? Is it a matter of monetary influences? Or is it simply pure ignorance?
It's a good question. So, I mean, when we're looking at energy sources in terms of how quickly you can deploy them, there is no real competitor for solar and onshore wind. These are sources of energy that can be rapidly deployed. They are reliable, especially when paired with battery storage, which allows you to store up energy during the day for solar or during those windy periods, maybe in the late afternoon with wind. And then you can deploy that at times when, you know, for example, the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing. So it's kind of hard to separate the kind of politicization of these and some of the maybe artificial constraints that have been placed on resources like solar and wind from their actual value to the grid.
The Trump administration, his EPA, also cut funding for Energize NC, which would have lowered energy bills for thousands of low-income residents. Why?
Why cut Energize NC? I'm not sure. This is a program that, again, would have helped expand access to solar in low-income neighborhoods. It also impacted a lot of solar installers that would have been participating in this program. These programs have a ripple effect. They're not only, you know, helping these low-income families access solar, which would in turn lower their monthly electricity bill, but it also helps boost this economy. We have a fairly substantial, I mean, North Carolina at one point in time was ranked number 4 in the nation for solar. This is a fairly large job market.
So let's talk about these credits and they're going away and what you have to do by next Friday to get the ball rolling on solar if you want to do it. You report that the final price per watt using this is going to be $1.95 for a solar system installed, which makes it under $10,000 for a small rooftop system. What does that mean? What will that power?
So one of the I went and I spoke with somebody on this past Saturday to talk to her about her. This is somebody that participated in the Solarize Charlotte Mecklenburg program to better understand like why she wanted to get solar in the first place and what it was like going through that program. The appeal of solar and how well it does in the state has always been tied to its rate of return, how quickly you can get that money back on your solar system. So for her, she ended up getting a relatively small system. This was a 13-panel or 5-kilowatt system. And she had gotten it partly because she was experiencing these blackouts. So she also got a battery, which allows her to use that solar energy when there is a blackout. And she said the payback for the system going through the Solarize program and also taking advantage of programs like Duke Energy's Power Pair, she would be able to get the return on that system in about 8 years, which is pretty quick compared to, you know, historical rates of return on these systems. So right now she has this opportunity. She was able to take advantage of the tax credit, but even for folks that apply now that are going to have their installations done in 2026, this is as low as it's going to be for a while.
Duke Energy is pretty cheap. I mean, when you compare it, the cost of electricity in this part of North Carolina to what's happening in other parts of the country, we come in at the bottom of the list. I mean, it's a good place to be. It's around 13.5 cents per kilowatt hour in Charlotte, as opposed to the national average of 17.4%, and it's much more expensive in other places. When you figure in the cost of installation, which results in about $1.95 per watt, how long does it take to pay this off? To recoup your investment and break even?
Right. That's a good question. I mean, if you're looking at it just in terms of the economic side of things, why you would be investing in solar energy, for this solar plus battery system, that was the one figure that I got from the homeowner on Saturdays. It was taking her about 8 years. But with that, that's with the tax credit. So afterwards, it's going to depend person to person. And I think the one important thing to point out about this program, SolarEye Charlotte Mecklenburg, is they will send somebody out to your house to give you that quote. And that doesn't cost anything to have that assessment.
So you mentioned 5 or 6 kilowatts a system, a solar system with 13 panels and a battery. What's the average house use? How big is that? Will that power a 2,500 square foot home for a day? How does that work?
Absolutely. So I was looking at some of the bills that this homeowner was showing me. This is a homeowner in East Charlotte. And it looks like she was able to offset most of her energy use for the entire month, you know, based on using this 13-panel system combined with that battery that's letting her draw power during times when the sun isn't directly shining on her home.
So if you proceed with this kind of an installation, if you're lucky enough to get in on this, we'll talk about that very quickly in a second. But if you do that, you're obviously having to pay for the system over time. Mm-hmm. Are you also paying Duke Energy an electric bill, or is that offsetting that electric bill completely?
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing about their Power Pair program that you can also take advantage of right now in this program. So this is specifically Duke's program that gives you up to $9,000 for a solar system with a battery attached. And you can enroll in this program that basically lets Duke tap into that battery during a certain number of events per year. And those credits that you generate through that program, as opposed to the solar credits that you get on your bill, those expire at the end of the year. With these battery credits, those can kind of roll over in perpetuity until you use them. So you have this ability to kind of like develop this base of credits to help offset your energy, especially during those like peak times of year when you might be using more and more energy to heat your home or cool it down during the dog days of summer.
I have to tell you that this all sounds incredibly complicated. Is it?
I think the nice thing about this program is that you'll have an opportunity to sit down and talk with somebody that will walk you through what this will mean for your house. They'll be able to tell you like, what is this going to look like on your power bill? And you'll be able to make that decision like, okay, this, maybe I have too much shade. Maybe it doesn't like make a whole lot of sense for my house particularly, or I don't have the kind of like roof real estate that I need. But it's not a decision, like it's going to vary person to person. And luckily, the county and the city are working with a reputable Charlotte-based solar installer that'll kind of walk you through that and be able to tell you like, okay, is this going to make sense for your house or not?
So this program ends on December 31st. And signing up for this program ends on Friday, November 28th, the day after Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Tax credits, as I said, end at the end of the year. Solar installers are already jammed with installation orders in advance of those expiration dates. Do you have to have your system installed by the end of the year, or just be on the list of having it installed because you put your name in by November 28th and you'll still qualify in 2026 for those credits if you don't get installed till, say, February?
I'm glad you asked. These solar installers have been filled since like August. I mean, as soon as President Trump's big, beautiful bill passed, people had started signing up, as it was a mad dash. And so folks' queues have been filled up for a while. It is highly unlikely that you would be able to get a system installed, basically put on your roof by the end of the year, which is what you would need to do to qualify for that tax credit. So signing up right now, you most likely would not be able to take advantage of the tax credit. Even though it expires at the end of the year, if you sign up now, you're probably not going to have the system in time installed in time to use that 30% tax credit. However, there are these other programs like the SolarEye Charlotte Mecklenburg program or Duke's Power Pair program that is approaching capacity that you can take advantage of now that will lower the cost of solar. And those programs, once they expire, it's always going to be even more expensive.
And the people who come out to talk to you under this program would know all those things and be able to explain it to you, because once again, this sounds also incredibly complicated. Is
Yes,
that
they
correct?
absolutely would be able to explain that to you. They'll be able to show you kind of a map of your home, how the panels would fit there, and what that would look like in terms of your electricity bill.
So, Zachary, I have less than 30 seconds. What will the end of these tax credits mean for the solar industry?
That's a big question. It looks like it's going to be more challenging. They're definitely going to be facing a little bit of a lean period. But the solar installers that I have talked to are optimistic that whether they're pivoting to leases or continuing on business as usual, they will be able to figure something out.
Okay, I hope they're smarter than I am, because let me tell you, my head is swimming right now. Zachary Turner, our climate reporter here at WFAE News. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.